You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Darrell Conner.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll find out what a national emergency declaration could mean for President Trump's efforts to create a border wall.
First, the loss of a loved one can launch a person into grief, and there's often a lot of questions about it, like how to grieve properly or how long it lasts. We hear a lot about the five stages of grief by Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, which are denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance.
But our next guest says there's something missing from that list that we need to deal with: anxiety.
Clara Bidwell-Smith is a licensed clinical professional counselor and a therapist who specializes in grief. She is the author of three books, and her latest is entitled Anxiety, the Missing Stage of Grief, a revolutionary approach to understanding and healing the impact of loss. Claire, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Claire, what exactly is anxiety?
Anxiety is the feeling that there is something wrong. It's often really just a feeling inside of us. There's a kind of dread or foreboding. Sometimes it's real, sometimes it's imagined. We can have anxiety about regular things, an upcoming trip, a talk we have to give. And then we can have anxiety about imagined things, worrying about our health, worrying that something bad is going to happen to someone we love. And some of that anxiety is normal and helpful. It helps us prepare for things and kind of stay on task. And then sometimes that anxiety really gets out of hand and takes over, and we begin to suffer from it in many different ways.
How does anxiety affect people exactly? And does it vary? And can it?
Yeah, it varies a lot. And one of the tricky things about it is that most people don't talk about it very much. Someone can have anxiety and you would never know. It can kind of be this silent predator that people are grappling with. Anxiety just comes in the form of a lot of nervousness, kind of preoccupied thoughts. We have a lot of physical symptoms that come with anxiety. We can get heart palpitations, we can get headaches, we can get nausea, we can have panic attacks, insomnia, social phobias, hypochondria. All kinds of things can come in hand with anxiety. It's a pretty gnarly beast.
We hear a lot about Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's five stages of grief, which are denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. Why, in your opinion, is anxiety the missing stage of grief?
Well, it's a very prevalent one. I've been a therapist in private practice for 10 years, and it's one of the symptoms I have seen in my grieving clients more than any other. I love Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. She is the pioneer of this conversation about grief and death and dying. When she coined those stages, they were originally applied to people who were facing a terminal diagnosis, so people who were dying. And those stages work really well for someone who's facing their own death. They do go through those stages. They do go through them in a pretty linear fashion. The stages grew so popular so quickly when she brought them out that they were kind of slapped onto the grieving process as well. And they don't work as well. And admittedly, she talks about that in some of her later writing, that they kind of got away from her in a sense, and that there's more to them. But anxiety is one that hasn't been talked about before in the grieving world. And yet it's something that a lot of people are really struggling with after they lose a loved one.
Yeah, why is it so frequently prompted by the loss of a loved one?
I think it's a few things. I think it's really having to face our mortality in a sudden and very significant way. You know, most of the time we're kind of going about our lives, you know, knowing that death is a real thing, but not really thinking about it. We're planning ahead and planning for our retirements and our vacations and our lives. And then someone close to us dies, and it's such a jarring realization that anything can happen at any time. And so it's really, it can just be really frightening. And then we start to worry about it happening in other contexts, other people, to ourselves. There's also this idea of with grief, it's a huge experience. It's one of the biggest things we go through as humans emotionally. And I think many people are not prepared for the multitude of emotions that come. And that can be itself very overwhelming and anxiety provoking.
Clara Bidwell-Smith is a licensed clinical professional counselor and a therapist that specializes in grief. She's the author of the latest book entitled Anxiety, the Missing Stage of Grief, a revolutionary approach to understanding and healing the impact of loss. And Claire, you have experience with anxiety as well as grief. And you have, as a therapist, have shared your past with your clients. Why did you feel it was necessary to do that?
It's just kind of been this path I've been on all my life. I lost my parents as a young adult. I was 18 when my mother died and 25 with my father. And they both had cancer. I'm an only child. So in essence, I kind of had no family by 25. It was incredibly difficult. And this was, you know, 15, 20 years ago. And things have changed in the grief world. But back then, there wasn't as much. There weren't as many resources. There weren't as many books. There weren't as many people really out there talking about this. And I kind of had to muddle my way through the grief process and was really struggling with a lot of anxiety in my grief, and nobody was talking about that. I just thought there was something wrong with me. Later, when I went back to school and began to study psychology, I was putting a lot of things together, and PTSD, I was studying all kinds of psychological trauma issues, and kind of just really seeing a lot of links there. And then when I became a therapist, I specialized in grief, and then I started seeing this in all of my clients as well. So I felt like it needed to be put out there. I love Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, like I said, but I want to continue opening up her work and broadening this conversation.
Now, Claire, you were talking about the fact that you started to see when you were counseling patients that the apparent symptom that you saw among grieving patients was anxiety. What was the point where you discovered that it was truly anxiety more than another symptom?
Well, they're all linked in interesting ways, right? There's a lot of anger. There's depression. There is the anxiety. They all come in waves and are linked to each other. But I started writing about anxiety and grief years ago, maybe 5 or 6 years ago. And when I did so and the articles began appearing, I had so many clients flooding to me, coming and telling me that they were having panic attacks after the loss of a loved one, or social anxieties, or a lot of hypochondria. And so I got this huge influx of anxious clients and was really able to kind of look at their grief process in correlation with the anxiety.
One of the first things you talk to patients about is that grief is normal. Why is normalizing anxiety important?
Normalizing both of them is really important. We have a really hard time talking about death in our culture. People don't want to talk about it. It's uncomfortable. It's depressing. It's scary. Anxiety is the same. People don't want to talk about it. They don't want to admit that they're struggling with it. They also just don't understand it. So I think beginning at a real baseline of talking about what is grief, what is anxiety, why do these things happen? They're very vulnerable states, right? Those are things we're not good at as humans. Brené Brown makes a living off of talking about vulnerability because we really need to keep talking about it. We need to explore those states that we go through as human beings. And I'm not sure there's a more vulnerable state than when you're grieving. So normalizing those things is really the first step. People come in and they want to get fixed. They think there's something wrong with them. Why am I still grieving? It's been 6 months. I should be over this. And really, it's normal to still be in the throes of grief at 6 months, even a year.
We're talking with Clara Bidwell-Smith. She is a licensed clinical professional counselor and the author of the book entitled Anxiety, The Missing Stage of Grief, A Revolutionary Approach to Understanding and Healing the Impact of Loss.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. How has grief and grieving affected your life after you lost a loved one? How did your grief affect you? And did you deal with anxiety as part of this process? If at all, are you managing it? Do you have a question for our guest about how anxiety works out in situations of grief? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@WPR.org.
We'll pick up the conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Darrell Connor. We're exploring anxiety and grief after a major loss with Clara Bidwell. She's the author of the book, Anxiety, The Missing Stage of Grief, A Revolutionary Approach to Understanding and Healing the Impact of Loss.
Is this your story? Have you been through a situation of grieving where you felt anxious, where you felt this anxiety our guest is talking about? We'd love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Share your story, how you dealt with it or tried to deal with it, or what you wish you knew then that you know now. Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org.
Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Bill in Wakefield. Good afternoon, Bill. Welcome to Central Time. Hello.
Hi, thank you so very much. Claire, what a great topic. I just want to give a little info. That's something I found out that some people kind of never get over it, like myself in a certain circumstance, that, you know, you have to isolate. You can't think good and bad at the same time. So you just kind of think of the good things and the good memories, and sooner or later, the kind of the moment will kind of dissipate. Thank you so very much.
Bill, thank you so much for the call. Claire, what exactly does grief look like?
Grief looks different for everybody. I mean, our relationship with the person we lost is as individual as the grief that we go through. And you can grieve differently for different people you've lost. It really depends. It depends on the way somebody died. It depends on if you were able to say goodbye, make amends for things, how their loss and absence affects your day-to-day life, you know? But grief just comes with many emotions. It comes with depression, and it comes with a sense of unfairness and anger. Like the caller just said, you know, it never goes away in some sense. I will get to the end of my life and still feel that it was unfair that my parents didn't get to see me into adulthood. It doesn't mean I'm still actively grieving and in pain every day, but I still miss them and think about them and wish they were here.
Is there a right way or a wrong way to grieve?
Definitely not. People wish there were. It's so hard to grieve, and it's so hard to lose somebody, and it's just painful and very uncomfortable. So everyone's always looking for a solution, a quick fix. You know, is there a right way to do it? Can I just get through this formula or do A, B, and C, and then I'll be done? Unfortunately, it's just different for everybody. The only right thing to do is to really let yourself feel all the things that come up.
Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Linda in Madison. Good afternoon, Linda. Welcome to Central Time. Hello.
Thank you.
Linda, what would you like to say to Claire?
I would like to say that my son died by suicide 3 years ago, and I experienced anxiety. And I'm first hearing about this now, and it's very helpful to hear. I think one of the things with the anxiety was I was afraid I wouldn't be able to control my emotions when I left the house. So that's when I experienced the most, is going out in public and then the stigma of suicide. And he was a veteran and it was with PTSD, but not everybody understands the entire grief that comes with stigma with suicide.
Linda, thank you so much for the call, and we are so sorry for your loss. Claire, how does grief anxiety differ from generalized anxiety?
Well, grief anxiety is really related to the loss itself, and it comes because you're not grieving or because you feel like you have to suppress your grief, as in the case of Linda, who just called. You know, she feels people don't understand what she's going through, or they don't understand, you know, the stigma of suicide is really scary to kind of walk around with. So when that happens, we end up pushing everything down and not letting the emotions process. And that's where the anxiety begins to bubble up. That fear of all the emotions, the fear of everything that's going on inside, the fear of how lonely it is when you're going through it. General anxiety can come on, and it can be hereditary in some ways. In some cases, you can also just have it due to various life circumstances. But the grief-related anxiety really specifically is tied to the loss and to your grief process itself.
We are talking with Claire Bidwell. She's the author of the book Anxiety, The Missing Stage of Grief, A Revolutionary Approach to Understanding and Healing the Impact of Loss. And we're exploring the issues of anxiety and grief after a major loss. Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Teresa in Eagle. Good afternoon, Teresa. Welcome to Central Time.
Hi. Your subject today is making me cry. I lost my mom, who was like my best friend. And I had anxiety problems, you know, in years past, and I could always rely on my mother. I could call her up and say, you know, Mom, I'm having a little anxiety issue, and she would talk me through it, and I'd get over it. So now I don't have that anymore, and it's just real painful. And I just think, you know, you're a wonderful person to be helping people because it's hard.
Teresa, thank you so much for your call, and we're sorry for your loss. Claire, you know, how do you deal with having somebody in your life, a loved one in your life that was always your rock when you had anxiety, and then they're gone? How do you go on, and how do you cope with that?
I mean, I think like this caller, it really is one of the reasons anxiety comes on. A lot of us lose our anchors. We lose our most important people, and life just feels completely different. And we feel, you know, kind of cast about in the world, which is very frightening and anxiety provoking. One of the things that I try to really do as a therapist with grief is to help people find a new sense of connection to their loved one. In the early days of grief psychology, there was a real push towards helping people let go and move on. And we've realized that that doesn't quite work, that what we need to do as humans is really hold on to our person and find a new sense of connection, whether that's spiritual, whether it's just an internal thing, whether we're talking to them or writing letters or thinking of them on certain occasions. It really makes a difference and makes us feel more grounded and centered in that grief process and in that connection.
Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Lynn in Milwaukee. Good afternoon, Lynn. Welcome to Central Time.
Hi. Hello. Hi. Claire, I totally relate to your anxiety theory. My brother died at age 55, 10 minutes before the end of his work shift. Totally unforeseen. Healthy guy, super vibrant and just left us. And I've always had really super duper low blood pressure. So if I get out of bed, I have to get out of bed slow. And if I gave blood, sometimes they'd send me away because my blood pressure is too low. And the minute he died, my blood pressure skyrocketed. And then I thought another thing, anxiety consequence from his demise was my skin itched, and I went to my dermatologist and said, I'm sure I have eczema, psoriasis, something's wrong, I have some skin disorder. And she looked at what I was talking about, and she said, nope, have you been through any stress? And I said, well, yeah, my brother just died. And she said, this is stress-related, a stress-related skin response. So it's probably from anxiety, I'm going to guess, because he was...
Absolutely.
Lynn, thank you so much for the call. You know, Claire, it's one thing when you lose someone, but they had been battling an illness and you kind of knew it was inevitable and you were able to prepare for it. I imagine it's always completely different and tragic when it happens suddenly to someone that didn't have any health problems, just something completely unexpected. How do you deal and cope with that?
You're right. They are different. It takes a lot longer to wrap your head around it when it's sudden. And there is a lot of anxiety that can come from it. As in the case of this caller, it can just make you feel like anything could happen at any moment. And it just feels so frightening. When someone has an illness, you have a little bit more time to come to terms with it. Some people don't, and it's still surprising. And it's still deeply painful in the moment when it happens, as though it had just, you know, come out of nowhere. But the ones that do truly come out of nowhere, it just takes a lot of work to really wrap your head around it, really understand that you're not going to see that person anymore. There's so much that's left undone and unsaid. And that's where it comes back to the work I was just talking about of trying to find that sense of connection to somebody after they're gone. One of the things I see a lot with grieving clients is guilt and remorse after a loss, something someone wishes they could do or say differently or just say it all or wish they could take back. And I think that it's never too late to do that work. I think we can still make amends with our people after they're gone. I think we can write letters. I think we can talk about it in therapy. I think we can work through things like that, and that's really helpful and important to the grief process.
Let's turn to strategies for coping with grief and anxiety. What are some options that people can do in order to cope with grief or anxiety or a combination of the two?
Well, I think first, you know, just recognizing that you're in it, that you're really grieving or that you're having anxiety. A lot of people are trying not to have them at all. So taking that first step of acknowledging that you're going through that, then finding either therapy, individual or support groups are so great for grieving individuals because you can feel less alone in your process and understand how other people are going through it as well. Reading books about it can be helpful too, just knowing that you're not alone in it. With the anxiety, there's a two-part process where you really have to work through your deep grief, because you're not going to get rid of the anxiety until you do. And then you have to do some work on the anxiety, some cognitive behavioral work, really changing your thoughts. We get stuck in a thought pattern of anxiety, thinking that we're going to get sick, thinking something else bad is going to happen. And there's a little work to be done around stopping those thoughts.
What resources would you suggest to someone who's struggling with grief and anxiety?
I mean, again, just really looking up some different grief books. There's some really wonderful new ones out there. Just looking on Amazon, there's tons of grief books. A support group, talking to someone at your local church or, you know, your community center. You're always surprised by how many people actually have been through deep grief. And once you start to talk about it, you can find a really great support system.
You know, there are a number of callers that are still on hold that want to share their story. I know one in particular said to get through grief, you have to come full circle. It's a process. And she's absolutely right. Grief is a journey. So what final advice would you offer to someone who is dealing with anxiety and grief?
I think we have to give ourselves over to it to a certain extent. We don't get through it until we go through it. So let grief transform you. There's an amazing opportunity to really learn about yourself and your world and the people around you and the way that you love. I think that grief can be transformational in a really beautiful way, but we kind of have to open up to it in order to get there.
Claire, thank you so much for joining us. We certainly appreciate the time.
Thank you.
Claire Bidwell-Smith is a licensed clinical professional counselor and the author of the book Anxiety, The Missing Stage of Grief, A Revolutionary Approach to Understanding and Healing the Impact of Loss.
President Trump is getting a firsthand look at the U.S.-Mexico border. He's in McAllen, Texas today, home to the country's biggest immigration processing center.
The trip comes on the 20th day of the partial federal government shutdown. Trump has said it won't end until Democrats agree to the $5.7 billion he wants for the border wall. House Democrats voted to reopen the government last week, but Senate Republicans say the bill is a non-starter because it doesn't fund the wall.
Before leaving the White House this morning, Trump told reporters that his preference is to work out a deal with Congress, but that the option of bypassing lawmakers is still on the table.
I have the absolute right to declare this was passed by Congress. So when you say was it passed by Congress, it was. Other presidents have used it, some fairly often. I have the absolute right to declare a national emergency. I haven't done it yet. I may do it. If this doesn't work out, probably I will do it. I would almost say definitely.
So what would that mean? Priscilla Alvarez is a reporter with CNN who covers immigration. Priscilla, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, before we get into what an emergency declaration would mean, where the money might come from to build some kind of border wall or barrier in this scenario, what is the latest between President Trump and Democrats? No signs of movement there today, right?
No, so talks right now are largely at an impasse. What we've actually seen over the last few days is that each side is sort of buckling down on their position. So Republicans are really pushing for the border security. Trump has shown no sign of folding on his request for the $5.7 billion for his border wall. And Democrats similarly have no intention at this point of providing the funds for to meet that request. And so at the moment, there's no sign that talks are moving forward and that anything would come to fruition in Congress.
So when it comes to this idea of saying, okay, national emergency and we'll find the funds elsewhere, I know there are different legal opinions on the whole of when a national emergency can be declared, but what roughly does the president have the power to do?
So under a national emergency, the president can dip into some funds. And in this case, we're looking at the Department of Defense. And the reason why is the Department of Defense has actually helped in the past the Department of Homeland Security with some structures along the border, specifically the Army Corps of Engineers. And so what's happening here is we are assuming that what they're going to be looking at in a declaration of a national emergency is Department of Defense funds. And there is actually a statute that does allow the president to dip into a pool of money for military construction projects in the event of a national emergency or declaration of war. And so it is under that statute that he would be able to find funds to put up a wall. And that is something that he's sort of been alluding to, saying directly that he could call a national emergency and get his wall, but we do not have a definitive yet on whether he will indeed do that.
In your reporting on this, you look at the various pools of money in the Department of Defense where this might come from, and there appears to be one where there's currently unspent money that seems like a likely target. What is that?
Yeah, so the unspent money is something that has gone back to prior years. So since around 2014, it's an accumulation of money that hasn't been spent, and that's what he can look to. Now, this money is money that in some cases has been promised, and so say that there is a project that is on the horizon, the Congress would have can say we've authorized for this money to go through to that, but the contract hasn't been signed and the funds have not been provided to that project yet. And so these are the unobligated funds. And so it is in those funds, in that big treasure trove of money, that he could grab some of those to put toward his border wall.
And then the military, it sounds like, if I'm reading your reporting right, the military does keep some money on hand for emergencies, unexpected construction needs. What kind of things might that ordinarily be used for?
Yeah, so say that a natural disaster hits a military base and they have to repair the military base as a result of that. So things like that, that there you wouldn't, sort of on contingency, you wouldn't know that that military base was going to be affected by a natural disaster, but that money is there in case that happens.
We're talking to Priscilla Alvarez from CNN, talking about the possibility of the president declaring a national emergency and dipping into Department of Defense money, potentially to pay for at least some of the border wall or barrier that he's hoping to build, especially in the event that he can't arrive at a deal with Congress to fund that. So, Priscilla, if the president did dip into this Department of Defense money, potentially it could be used to build a wall at the expense of something else that the Department of Defense was expecting to use it for.
Yes, that is what could happen. It could be diverting the funds diverting funds that would have otherwise gone to other military projects that would instead be put toward the wall. Again, we don't have any specificity as to exactly which projects this would touch, or if he even intends on doing this at this point. But that is what could happen, certainly.
Now, of course, we can't read the minds of anybody involved in this standoff, but is it a possibility that the president is pointing toward this emergency declaration as maybe a bargaining chip, something hoping to keep Democrats at the table for negotiations?
His statements today indicate that he certainly sees this in the realm of possibility. So he knows he has the authority to declare a national emergency and has been repeating it more now as talks has sort of deteriorated over the week. He continues to say that he is still wants to find a solution in Congress, but as far as using it as a bargaining chip, that is sort of perhaps something that would be discussed behind the scenes. I can't say with certainty that that's what it's being used as. What we do know is that he sees it as an authority of his. This is something that has been discussed among officials, and it kind of depends on how things go in Congress in the next few days.
Now, do we have any idea of what constitutes an emergency for the president's ability to declare a state of national emergency? Do there have to be certain preconditions met?
That's something I've been talking to legal experts about. As far as I understand, it is fairly broad. But what legal experts have all pointed and said is what's really going to matter here is when he declares a national emergency, how does he define that emergency? What exactly is at risk here? How does the administration lay that out? And in looking at that, certainly it might welcome some legal challenges, but that's going to be the one big thing to look at is when he declares it, how exactly does he define it, and how does it warrant what he's asking for?
Right. Some people have been pointing toward the couple of years where we had President Trump and a Republican majority in Congress, in both chambers of Congress, and none of this border wall funding then, and asking, okay, what's the difference between now and the last 2 years that makes this period of time an emergency? Is that an argument people are having? Is that something that would make any difference in a court?
People are having that conversation as far as apprehension numbers. This is something that we've seen administration officials talk a lot about. So something that they've continued to say is that there is an uptick from 2017 when we've seen a historic low. Within the grander context, of course, in the early 2000s, we saw apprehensions topping a million. So those figures are ones that the administration has pointed to as saying that right now things are worse off than they have been. It is important in taking those statements and looking at them within the larger context. As far as the lawsuits, a lot of that is, going to depend again on how it is defined and also who is at injury here. So is there any potential of the border wall being constructed on private property, in which case that opens up eminent domain, and whether there are private individuals suing to keep their property. Again, I want to clear up, though, that situation is not one that is just related to the national emergency. That can happen in any instance. But those are the types of conversations that will be occurring in the event that a wall goes up.
We're talking about the possibility of funding a southern border wall without congressional approval, with a declaration of emergency, potentially something the president has talked about. Priscilla Alvarez is with us, reporter with CNN who covers immigration issues.
And we want to hear from you. What do you think? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about the idea of President Trump bypassing Congress to get the wall? Do you see the border situation as a national emergency or not? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR.
We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Darrell Conner. We're continuing our discussion on border wall funding and the possibility of President Trump declaring a national emergency to get around Congress.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to the notion of using military funds to build the wall? Should the president continue to work with Congress to try to secure the $5.7 billion in funding he wants, or do you see that as a lost cause? What questions do you have about the president's ability to call a national emergency or what he can do in this situation? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll go to your calls now. Charlie is with us in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I guess I would say that, yes, there's a national emergency right now, but it's not specific to a wall or to anything else. Our real national emergency is the fact that we are not able to talk to each other and we're not able to compromise. If it's not the wall this week, next week it's going to be the budget. If it's not the budget, it's going to be military spending. It's going to be taxation. People are so divided right now, and without any ability to compromise or even talk to each other, that the national emergency is the fact that as free people, we can't govern ourselves. And that is a true problem.
Charlie, thanks a lot for the call. And Priscilla, Charlie's talking about gridlock in Congress, the inability to compromise and work together. And if there's one issue that's a poster child for that, not just this year, but in, I don't know what, the last decade, two decades, it's immigration. What do you see in Congress when it comes to the divide over immigration policy?
Immigration policy has always been a complicated one in Congress. And what we've seen over the last years is that in any moment where one piece of legislation is introduced to reform some part of immigration, so for example, I'm thinking about the DREAM Act, which would be to provide a legal path to citizenship for DACA recipients. Those types of situations often welcome other measures to reform the immigration system. And what happens in those scenarios is that you have a lot of different reforms that come to the table where Democrats and Republicans may not agree. And so it creates just more gridlock, really, and doesn't provide much room for immigration reform to move forward. So this is something that has been ongoing for years. It was difficult to pass reform in the Bush era. It was difficult under Obama. And currently, with the highly partisan nature of Congress, one would expect that it would only get more difficult, more challenging right now.
Thanks for the call, Charlie. We're next to Mike with us in Lake Mills. Mike, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me on. My question is, if this gives the president the power over the military money, but does it give him the power over the military to deploy troops?
Mike, thanks for the call. Priscilla?
So that's a great question. What I can say is based off my own reporting, which is that it would give him direct money over the direct control over the money in these coffers, and that in turn would task the military with some projects. But that is the most that I can speak to on that matter, though it is a good question.
Thanks for the call. And Priscilla, that reminds me, you wrote about the future if, say, the Army Corps of Engineers is building barriers, walls, structures, whatever we want to call them. Then does the military maintain them? Does the military control them, patrol them? Those are also open questions, right?
Well, this is something that works in conjunction with DHS. We don't know what this is going to look like in the event of a national emergency. For example, as you raise, is DOD going to take control over parts of the border? Will DHS continue its functions and DOD will supplement them by building additional barriers? We don't know the answer to those yet.
Go back to our callers now. Debbie is with us in Dodgeville. Debbie, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Debbie?
Well, I just think, I don't think it's a state of an emergency at all. If the emergencies I see in this country is Medicare, Medicaid for people that don't have anything, their billions of dollars should go for that instead of a wall to try to keep people out, because people are going to get in any way they can if they want.
Debbie, thanks a lot for the call. Are we hearing Democrats objecting to the idea of declaring a state of emergency along those grounds, saying this isn't really an emergency, Priscilla?
Yeah, I mean, Democrats are opposed to the idea and have pushed back against declaring a national emergency because they simply don't see it that way. And again, they point to some of the data, which shows that we do have a shift of the population of those that are being apprehended at the border. They are families and children, and they should be looked at in sort of a humanitarian way and sort of acknowledging that there are push factors in Central America that are driving them up to the border. But they, at least as far as the national emergency and the border security and it possibly creating a national threat, they have pushed back against that idea.
Thanks for the call. We are talking to Priscilla Alvarez, immigration reporter with CNN, looking at the latest in the border security debate. President Trump saying if Congress and he can't arrive at a deal to end the shutdown and fund the border wall to the tune of over $6 billion, he probably in some cases, or he said definitely in some cases, would use some sort of national emergency declaration to use military money to build at least some of a border structure. Back to your calls now. John is with us in Shell Lake. John, hi.
How you doing?
Good. What do you think?
Well, I don't think there's any national emergency at all. I think if you take the statistics that Trump spouts, which are almost all lies, and I only use the word almost in case I missed something somewhere that was the truth. The wall is a moronic idea. I've seen videos on television of what parts of the wall that do exist, of people sneaking up to it with portable acetylene torches, cutting holes in it, people running through it. They've already proven that with GPS and stuff, they can tunnel from Tijuana to San Diego and come up through the floor in any storage unit that they want to. I mean, a wall is just absurd. But my second point is, when they arrested El Chapo and froze his assets, if I remember right, that number that they froze or confiscated from him was like $140 or $240 billion. Whose pocket did that money go into? It's enough money to build 6 or 8 of those walls.
John, thanks for the call. I don't know if you followed that particular story of El Chapo and where his money went, Priscilla. But to his first point, there is still debate on whether a physical structure, a wall, a barrier, is the best way to boost border security. What are some of the arguments there?
So CBP has said over time that there are certainly areas of the border where it helps to have some barriers erected. And again, we shouldn't forget that there is some variation of fencing along some 650 miles of the border. But what we are seeing now, which is particularly interesting and unique, is that the people that are approaching the border, again, going back to those families and children, are presenting themselves to Border Patrol agents or trying to come through ports of entry, not evading capture. So assuming that more miles are built of the wall that Trump wants, what you would see in this scenario is likely people going to ports of entry, as some already have, to claim asylum. That is the key here, and something that the government has also noted is that there has been a big increase in claims of asylum. We do know that there are areas where it could be helpful based off CBP's plans, but we also know that it wouldn't necessarily just end the flow altogether, or at least that is the assumption based on how many people are here to claim asylum and, with that said, present themselves to CBP.
In our last few moments, Priscilla, we've been in this deadlock in the same position for a while, and yet it seems like in some ways the story is constantly changing. What is the next thing you're watching for now?
So right now we're basically watching whether there will be any budging in Congress on either end, whether there's any possibility of a deal in Congress, and whether this ramps up to the possibility of a national emergency.
We'll leave it there for now. Priscilla, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Priscilla Alvarez. She's an immigration reporter with CNN. We talked with her about the possibility of President Trump declaring a national emergency. She's been reporting on this. The goal would be to pay for a wall on the U.S.-Mexico border. We've been talking about how that might actually work.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we're in the midst of a partial shutdown of the federal government. But shutdowns haven't always been a part of the political landscape. An expert on the federal budget gives us the history and evolution of the shutdown.
Peter Sagal from Wait, Don't Tell Me, joins the show. He is a radio person like me. Unlike me, he really likes to go running. He likes it a lot, so much he just came out with a whole book, a memoir about his love of running. He'll join the show and talk about why he likes to run.
And on this week's edition of Food Friday, food science expert Dr. Stu tells us about the science of spices and how we can get the most flavor in our cooking.
We've talked to Dr. Stu a couple times in the past about food science. It's always a lot of fun. Looking forward to learn what I'm doing wrong with my spices when I'm cooking. That's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.